I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it, or in this case, a global conversation in an American frame. With Romano Prodi, the former Prime Minister of Italy, and Ricardo Lagos, former President of Chile, we are, in effect, hanging out in the clubhouse of candid social democratic statesmen in Providence, Rhode Island, inquiring about the Obama effect on the world stage, trying to get the picture out there, but also, in the poet Bobby Burns' famous prayer, we're trying to see ourselves as others see us. Our guests in this conversation have been famously more than candid. Mr. Lagos is the man who pointed his finger at General Pinochet at the end of the 1980s and said, "No, you will not give us another 8 years of tortures, murders, and human rights violations," and he lived to tell about it. Mr. Prodi is the not Berlusconi of Italian politics. He led the opposition coalition that encompassed Catholic and Communist parties, and he beat the Berlusconi alliance in 1996. Both of these men have played huge international roles in the European Commission, in the United Nations. Who better to watch the global storm with us and to reflect on the Obama effect, the new president, in a world that we've really never seen before? We imagine three zones of this conversation. First, the crisis. Second, the rest of the world's agenda in foreign policy. And third, this man, Obama, the toast of Europe for this past week, and still the serene, reassuring listener, the arc of the hopes of so many people and so many places. Begin with the crisis. Mr. Lagos, when your grandchildren ask you, "Grandpa, how bad is it and what is it?" what do you tell them? As they say on American television, is it bigger than a bread box? Is it as bad as a tsunami?
It's very bad. What I think is that the origin of the crisis has very much to do with the way that the U.S. and the Americans were living beyond the standard of living that they can be living. The fact that you have tremendous deficit, and the deficit has to be financed. Mm-hmm. Somebody else was financing the deficit. This is mainly China. And after that, then, you have a lot of things with that financing instrument, and what are you going to do with the financial instruments? And then you have the super borrowers, those that are doing with the bigger financial instruments, and this is where we are now. Nevertheless, let me tell you this. The origin of the crisis is clear. What is not so clear is what is going to be the final outcome. But I would say this. Every society need to have, through the citizens, some kind of people in power to rule the market. Every society also has consumers. And as consumers, they participate in the market. When you have only citizens and the state, and no more than that, then probably the Berlin Wall is going to fall. You see what I mean? What was the Soviet system other than the people and the state? That's it. Some people thought that was possible to have also something relation between here and the market, and the market take themselves care of them. And this is not true. And Alan Greenspan has to recognize that he was wrong when he thought that the financing system can be self-regulated. So now I think that because of the crisis, it's going to be necessary to think in a different way, and very similar to what happened here in this country 80 years ago with Roosevelt, there's going to be some sort of new regulations in order to solve the crisis. And this is where we are in the middle of.
When we come back, I want to ask you how far beyond new regulations and new laws it could also go. Your friend, also a fellow at Watson, Alfred Gusenbauer, said the other day, this is the kind of crisis which, over the span of history, would normally cause a revolution or a war. How do you define it?
Be calm. I say, don't overdo. No, We have not yet reached that point, I shall tell to my friend Gusenbauer, because there are social amortizers, you know, social cushions that work even in countries like US, where you have not many, you know, we have not still reached the point of having a revolution. This is simply the truth of this moment. Of course, if this could go on for a long time, maybe we have some unrest. But I don't say I'm optimist, because it's not true, but I am less pessimist about that. Because
I'm fascinated to get a social democratic perspective on what this is, and a less polite European angle on the American situation than President Obama got, perhaps, in public. What does a social democrat make of this thing?
But, you know, this is clearly the crisis started inside the United States. No doubt about that.
Give London a little credit.
Well, I could say maybe part of United States. Included, you know. And in this sense, in London, it was, it is my experience, you know. When we try to have financial regulations, London generally opposed it. Now, the British government, is in the first line defending the necessity of new regulation of the market economy. Let's say the thinking that you had in London 1 year ago has nothing to do with the proposal that the British Prime Minister did in the last meeting in London. And this is a fantastic change, you know.
Would you just cut through something, though, that I think is there between the lines in the European commentary? When the head of the European Union said the Obama stimulus is the road to hell.
Well, somebody told that, but not everybody. No, but Europe in this meeting was simply divided in the sense that always, you know, you had countries in safe and good conditions. You had other burdened by heavy debt. So it's difficult to talk about Europe at this moment, you know. It's clear that the future growth of the world depends upon the enlargement of the demand in new countries.
And who's going to do that? What this system?
In this moment, simply the different rate of growth. It's happening, you know. When China grows at 8% per year and we grow at 2.5, you know, the redistribution is coming. The problem that now we have not everybody that is taking part of that, but don't forget that in the last 3 years, even Africa was growing, starting from a very low point, but even Africa was growing more than Europe. And, you know, the redistribution, you can do it with a different rate of growth, but you cannot do it with a going back of the wealthy country. First of all, because you will have a revolution, and the world economy will go in disarray. And second, because simply this will completely put in danger all the development of the economy. The problem is to put in order the financial market that now are completely broken.
Let me add a few things that I do believe is extremely important. What happened in the G20? It has been presented not very much in the media, but of the package of $1 trillion. Half of that will be given by different countries, the U.S., Japan, Europe, etc. But a quarter of that, $250 billion, is going to be something called SDR, a special drawing rights. What is that, the special drawing rights? A special drawing rights, let me put it this way, is the money that can create the International Monetary Fund when all the countries that form the, that are in that institution agree to emit money. And this is called a special drawing rights. Why I say this is so important? Because this means that in the world of the future, you may have an institution like that that has the power to print money. Not dollars, not euros, not yuans from China, but that would be the first time that the global, multilateral, international institutions is going to create money. You remember in your history classes when they told you that the right to coin the money of the feudal laws were transferred to the king in a national country? And that was the pass of the power from the feudal system to the national state. When the G20 say the International Monetary Fund is able to emit a quarter of $1 trillion, is saying that this international institution is going a similar decision that from the national state we can print the money, the US dollar, the euro, whatever. Now, an international institution. This, I think, is a tremendous step forward toward a multilateral world. And I do believe that it's going to represent an important fact when in the future historians write the history of this period, this decision to establish that.
Yeah. And it is interesting that the Chinese are backing it.
Yeah.
They were outside the system till a few weeks ago. And then suddenly, when they enter into the system, it was by the Chinese, the proposal to enlarge the system of drawing, of International Monetary Fund, you know. So in very few weeks, you had this change. But this change is enormous, because if you go in this direction, the Chinese currency that was simply inexistent in the traditional market will become a protagonist, you know. And the Chinese has always been very, you know, intensively thinking about that, because you mentioned it in the presentation, the birth of the euro. But when I was president of the commission talking with the Chinese, you know, they fixed conversation with me was, look, so we can choose between dollar and euro. We can have a choice. Mm. And then in few years, very few years, there is a third choice, them. So you know how the world has changed. I was telling in a few months, but let's say in few years, you know. And then how we'll be settled in the future will be done in the next month. This is why it's so important, you know, the new American presidency should be of equal importance to have a European united action that we still have not, you know, because now we settle the new settlement of the world in the next months.
I want to ask you one more question, both of you, about the general dimensions of this so-called crisis. It seems to me broadly that the politics is trailing behind the economic diagnoses, and the human questions are trailing behind both of the others. In other words, it's not just a matter of economic regulation or governance, with all due respect. There are also deep questions here about haves and have-nots in the world. And there's still to come, it seems to me, people want to hear a venting of questions about finance capital and its values, which come up pretty much as an extreme individualism, consumption, I don't want to say just greed, but looking out for oneself, which can become a race to the bottom competition. I think people want at least to hear the implications for this crisis for other values, including, you know, liberty, equality, fraternity, and maybe even faith, hope, and charity before it's done, but some reconsideration of the human values in this economic system.
I hope you are right, but I don't think so. You know, when you talk with people, they are simply frightened of what will happen tomorrow to their daily life. You know, this is the first preoccupation right. that I feel, and I hope that you know, the intellectuals and, you know, they think how the reorganization of the world will come in the future. But in this moment, the attention is really on the fear to lose the level of living we have now, especially, you know, the normal feeling inside the United States. You know, people are thinking about pension funds.
Of course.
You know, do I retire? The conversation I had, I don't know when is more convenient to retire, what will be the future of my pension fund, you know. So when you think to the things, it's difficult to think to philosophical change of the world, you know. We can do it when we shall let the power depositing, you know, on the ground, you know. This is why I'm so, for me, it's so important to give a hope for the resolution of the crisis. And honestly, I think that the modest G20 meeting was a progress. I'm, you know, the idea that there is maybe somebody in command is coming, you know. And of course, maybe I'm too optimist, but I feel less the sense that the world is without hope, you know. And when we will start the recovery, I think that we can think also to your positive message on social justice and so on. In this moment, the tension that I feel is when the recovery will come. Now, I think, and I hope not to be wrong, we are already at the bottom of the crisis. This bottom can go on, but I don't think that we shall go down. I feel some small signal in China. I'm picking up some. That does not mean we are optimist, but I think that the fear of 29 or this world crisis, I think, is over. And
well, I guess, Romano, you are right when you say that we hope that we already know that we are in the bottom and we are not going to be beyond the bottom.
Hmm? Yeah.
Because that then will be...
Yeah, but this is important.
I want your view but, on the human dimension here.
But the human dimension, why I think it's so important, the human dimension here, for a very simplest reason. Because of the crisis, politics is back. Hmm. Politics is back. Have you listened to some other... What Obama is going to do? Oh, I don't think that Gordon Brown is doing the right thing. Sarkozy may have the reason. No, I don't think that Sarkozy is correct. I think that President Lula is right when he's talking about, my goodness, all of us are talking about politicians trying to solve the crisis. That's why I say politics is back. And why politics is back? Because now citizens are in command. And when citizens are in command, it's a quite different from consumers are in command. Consumers are in command of the market. All of us are consumers. Our pocket is a little bit different. As citizens, all of us are citizens. And as citizens, all of us are equal. And when citizens are in command and say, this is too serious, now politics is back, I give the orders. And this is to have the human being in the center stage. And this is why all the discussion about a stimulus package, how good, how bad, how rapidly, with what velocity, with what speed are we going to implement the package, this is essential. And this has to do with employment, They have to do with wages. They have to do with standard of living. They have to do with everything. In other words, I think that in the moment where we are now, during a long time, in the way to be out of the crisis, politics will be back. And therefore, what our representatives, what our congressmen, our senators are doing is extremely important, how they are going to vote in Congress, because this is going to be, it's very clear that to solve the issue is not going to be done by the market forces. It's going to be through economic policies. And this is going to be the big discussion, and therefore I think that the question is that after what happened with the crisis and the bonus and all those things that is going on in discussion these days, is going to be some going back to fundamental values, as you say.
Yeah, I hear you
say... The way is going to go in that direction. I have no doubt on that.
I hear the history of your own experience in Chile in the background of what you're saying, that life comes back in a different way after that sort of blight.
Yeah.
Could I just sort of ease into the sort of second general zone of questions we wanted to talk about, which is foreign policy in general, and the degree I'd like you to both to speak about the ways in which the whole landscape and the whole priority list in the world has changed in the transition, in our transition from Bush to Obama. We can't cover it all. We can't cover the Middle East and Africa and Latin America and immigration and climate and drugs and so many other things. I wish you'd just take one or two representative areas that are especially interesting to you, where there is a new problem to be addressed or a new foothold against kind of serious threats.
You correctly told that the world has changed, really, with the passage from Bush to Obama, and Obama uses even a wording that was absolutely absent from the previous American dictionary, you know. That's true. The wording is completely different. Dialogue, the word dialogue, it was, you know, is a new one. Is a new one, you know.
He also listens.
Yes, he also listens. Yes, but I'm serious now. With this new attitude, I think will give results. You are asking me which could be the priority. Now I am guessing, you know, because the priority will also depend upon the reaction of others. But I think that U.S. need to close some of the, let's say, problems that they have on the table. The first one, in my opinion, the easiest to solve is relation with Russia. Russia is taken by the crisis. There is a possibility of doubts, you know, of common interest in exchanging actions. Let's say I withdraw missiles, you don't bring NATO to Ukraine and the Caucasus area, and on the table there are possibility of agreements, and I think that U.S. has interest to close the problem with Russia. Russia has the same interest, and both of them can be of mutual help in order to solve or to tackle the Afghanistan problem. You know, and this is the first step that I see. I repeat, I have no hidden information. I may be wrong. I simply analyze interests and possibilities that are on the fields. Then other steps, they need more meetings, more understanding, more, let's say, dialogue with Iran. Is still difficult. There are elections, there are problems, you know. The Palestinian issue needs a lot of internal change, both inside the American policy and outside. These are all problems that may come later. The first possibility to be solved on the table, in my opinion, are Russian-American relations that were very tough in the last period. They were tough. They divided Europe. Don't forget that the tension with Russia divided Poland from Germany even more. You know, they are serious problem. But here there is the possibility. You asked me where I see the possibility of change. Here I see realistically the first one is on the relation with Russia.
Yeah, interesting. Mr. Lagos.
15 years ago, there was a huge conference right after some peace agreement in Oslo, in Madrid, about how can we advance with regard to the question of Palestinian and Israelis. And at the end of the discussion, everybody used to say, well, we are in the middle of a tunnel, and we cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel. 15 years later, there was again a huge gathering in Madrid to commemorate what was the discussion 15 years ago. And somebody in the room that has been in the first meeting made a wonderful statement. I found it, at least found it, and I want to share it with you. He said, I remember that 15 years ago we said that we were in the middle of a tunnel and we couldn't see the light at the end of that. But 15 years later, we all know where is the light. And all in this room knows that at the end of this conflict, we are going to have two states, Israel and Palestinian. Like what was the resolution that was mentioned by the United Nations many, many, many years ago. But the only problem that we have is worse. Because now we see the light at the end of the tunnel. The problem now is that we cannot find the tunnel. And I think that this is exactly the case. Because 15 years later, there is no question that you will need to have a Palestinian and an Israeli state with boundaries, etc., etc., all those things. Are we going to be able to have enough leverage through a dialogue in the way that has been discussed either by the group of four or whatever is going to be the number of the group in connection with that? Or are we going to keep waiting for another 15 years to have another meeting in Madrid to commemorate the two previous conferences?
I'd love you both to make a connection with Iran, which bears on the Russian relationship, it bears on the Israeli-Palestinian situation.
Yes.
What's the opportunity, and how would you go about it?
Well, I was in Iran even recently. Now, even in a special way, they are in the election mode, and so you must leave the country. You know, because it's a tough election, the election of the President of the Republic, you know, and this will give a signal of possible change. In this moment is not the case of having it. But Obama has been very intelligent with this new wording. He told them, look, there is a possibility of dialogue. Make up your mind. This I understood. This is the message of Obama. Make up your mind. I'm listening, but you know I give you time in this moment of election, and I don't exclude that a dialogue can start. You know, it's I in my meeting I told them very openly. You know, it's. Because with the Iranian, if you don't speak shortly and openly, then in few minutes you don't understand anything because they are so able in arguing, you know, that they are sophisticated like nobody in the world, you know. So I told them a few messages. First of all, you must make a monument to George W. Bush because he destroyed all your enemies. And they were saying, yes, you know, it's, consider what happened to Iraq, and then the problem of all the frontiers, you know, it's, it was not wanted, but this has been the consequence, you know. This was the first battle. Second, you have never been so powerful. It's time that you are wise and you make peace. This is what I told to Ahmadinejad in United Nations, and then a few months ago here, you know. And I think that this is the moment to tell them clear that we are open if they accept the reality, you know, and if they internalize that is so difficult and so confused, the powder that they inside the country will deposit a bit. I think that this firm but open policy can give results, you know, can give results. When I met Ahmadinejad in the United Nations, you know, after he was just arguing in this long way.
Who'd you meet? Oh,
Ahmadinejad. Ahmadinejad, yes. I told him.
The actual president.
Huh?
The actual president.
Yeah. I told him, look, when. Be careful, because I do remember that when we were students, we had a very beautiful girl that was at school with us, you know. Mm. Everybody was courting her, and she said no to everybody. And after many, many years, I met her in my hometown, and she was still alone, you know. And so be careful, because you are in this position. You have to decide, you know. And no, after 1 hour of discussion, then you have to say, look, you have to decide, you know. And then when I met this year, a few months ago, in the end of last year, I entered his room. How is your friend? He understood the lesson, you know. He's still alone. Yes, he's still alone. And you know, this is the situation that you have to clarify with Iran. Say, telling them clearly which is the line, and giving them the possibility of having a deal, but also telling clearly that we are determined to make a policy in which they cannot be a menace, and they have all the interest to deal now, because they will never be powerful as they are now. This is what I think.
That's true. The point is that you have to understand and distinguish what are the different characters, because they elect, as you say, they are in the middle of an election, and when Khatami was president, Khatami was a much more open president, much more, quote, liberal president, given the fact of what is Iranian society. And then, if you don't understand that it's much better to deal with that kind of people than with the other, then this is the biggest problem, you know. When you are close to a solution, you have to give so many things to find finally a common ground. If you fail, well, the hardliners in both sides are going to become stronger. This is by definition the case, you know. I told you that you shouldn't give so much, will say the hardliner. And therefore, in the case of Iran, it's so important to distinguish who are your alternative, who are going to be the different positions vis-a-vis any particular republic, which such an important religious leaders that sometimes are much more important than those that are elected. Therefore, from the point of view, I wouldn't say United States, from the point of view of the world, to understand what's going on there and how position has to be taken in such a way to go in the right direction. People that is more open for more democratic values, that or those that we have, those are the people that you have to push a little bit around.
President Lagos, I want to change the subject completely just to get you to say what you said to me the other day, where you said, you know what Latin America is really concerned about? And you said, Mexico, and the United States is part of the problem. Give us that story as briefly as you can.
Well,
that was a tunnel story, too.
That's a problem, you know. When you're president and they ask you something like that, then you sit around the table and say, Minister, why don't you answer that question? And I have no minister around, you know, so. But anyhow, the point I would say is this. I think that the situation in Mexico is extremely difficult from the point of view of security. And what's going on there, I have the impression that the success of President Uribe in Colombia has made that many of the people, the drug traffickers that used to work in Colombia, has been moving to Mexico. And from Mexico, of course, the U.S. Now, the problem is that the U.S. is the major market for the drugs, and the problem is that the U.S. supplies about 80% of the armament for the drug traffickers. And the problem is that in most cases, the tunnels, these are real tunnels, not like the other of the Palestinian and Jews, the tunnel that smuggle cocaine goes from Mexico to the U.S., but I have been told that all of them has been discovered in the Mexican side. Wow. That's something to think about. And that's something to worry about. Because as far as I know, the tunnel has two entrances, and therefore I would be worried to learn that situation. And President Calderon is taking tremendous steps. The army is involved. And all of us know that when you involve the army is the last resort. After that, what? And the question in Mexico is extremely serious. And therefore, I think that this is a problem not only from the point of view of Mexicans, but here I think, for instance, that the signal sent by President Obama is extremely important. The highest ranking official in this area, like the Attorney General and Napolitano, went there in preparation to the next visit that President Obama is going to make to Mexico. So I think that this administration has taken the right steps in order to face the issue and to face the problem, because in the way that it is, this is going to be a problem not only from the point of view of Mexico, but from the point of view of Mexico and U.S., and probably the whole hemisphere. This is, I guess, is the most serious question that we have right now. Yeah.
Could I ask you both, just in a quick phase three here, just to reflect on Barack Obama, the man, the politician, this fantastically charismatic world player now. I think we, if we're lucky, we will remember this as a kind of age of Obama. But I would love to hear you talk as politicians just about another politician. What is his secret? What is his charm? What's the magic? Will there ever be an Obama in Italy, in Chile? Doesn't everybody want an Obama now? But what does it mean?
Look, these things happens only in very few cases in history. I think that if somebody of you have listened, it was my chance that I did it on television. I was already here. The debate that Obama had in Strasbourg with a debate with people. It was something that was absolutely unusual in world politics, you know. The President of the United States talking directly with people, answering to the question directly. And he has shown the courage, intelligence, wit. It was witty also. And the secret is certainly the high IQ, but also the self-confidence that that he has, you know. You can have this in all the countries, I think you can have in Chile. In Italy, the problem is to have it, you know. Why not? There are a lot of intelligent people, there are a lot, you know. But I think that Obama is also the fruit of an open competition in policy, an open market, with all the limits of American political arena, the money flowing up, you know, but is an open market, you know, and this is not the case in all other countries, certainly not the case in many European countries with the party structure are organized in such a way that this type of newcomers have a lot of difficulties to get out, you know. And certainly, you from, you know, an observer's view, you find him that when he's speaking from the podium, he has an enormous force. Sometimes when you see around the table, it looks like, you know, more shy or more... when you know, you've seen it in Strasbourg, talking openly, the American president talking openly to young people, answering to their questions.
And in London, nobody could remember a politician getting a standing ovation from a London news conference from these hardened, nasty journalists either. Part of my question, maybe for you, Mr. Lagos, is simply, what do we make of this gap between Obama and even his staff? I sense that, I mean, the Larry Summers of the world and the Richard Holbrooks and the Hillary Clintons are doing what they always did. I mean, they're professionals doing their best. And yet, my hope is in some reserve of imagination, surprise, a deeper understanding in the man himself.
Well, there is no question that Obama, precisely because of his election and where he is coming from the international point of view, he has an open agenda. Open, clean agenda. Nobody will tell him, look what your predecessor did, or look what happened so and so and so. I mean, he is something absolutely new. And therefore, the agenda is clean, it's open. Number two, I would say, to lead in a real way, you have to speak with the truth. And in many occasions, to speak with the truth means to say something unpleasant. But you have to do it, and a real leader is able to explain that. Because trust that the people will understand why they have to listen such an unpleasant truth. You see what I mean? Tomorrow I will decrease salaries in this country for 20%. My goodness. It's not to say bravo. But then you have to explain that. Then you have to explain. Let me tell you, I did something as a candidate that the candidate had never do, which is to put numbers. And I say, in my first year in government, 200,000 people will be employed. And we are in a small country, and 2,000 is quite a number when you are 15 million people living down in Chile. And I failed. And I discovered that I was going to fail in September. So in September, I went to the press to explain why I was going to fail. And I was not going to be able to fulfill the 200,000. And then I explained why, because of the Asian crisis, etc., etc., etc. And you know something? People understood. I only complain because in my last year in government, finally, I got the 200,000. But anyhow, you know, what I do think is that it's so important if you want to connect with them. And this is what this difficult equilibrium is what has been doing Obama in this first 100 days in office. How I explain how deep is the crisis and why things are going to be worse tomorrow of what they are today. But at the same time, I know, because I'm a leader, how I'm going to take the boat to go to where I think we should go. So there are two things. You have to explain, but you have to take the same path that you decided in advance. Hmm. And in many cases, your advisors are going to tell you, this is not what you have to do, Mr. President. Hmm. But a final anecdote. Once they told me that I have to privatize a very important energy company that belongs to the state. And I knew that all the ministers that came to see me and advisors wanted to do that. So finally I say, okay, gentlemen, let's have a vote. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 9 votes to privatize the company. 1 vote against. Since we are in the democracy and I'm the president, the vote, 1 vote overcome the other 9. Well, but that means, you know, that you have to be very clear that sometimes you have to be above the advisors. And this is the way that you feel that you connect. Probably you are wrong. But this is not to say that you are going to make a stupid thing. No. But the question is that sometimes you have to be. And it seems to me that many occasions what Obama does is precisely that, to go astray. When he decided to have this open talk with the people, he has to be extremely sure of what he's doing and has a tremendous self-esteem that he can handle the most difficult questions. But I'm sure that if someday somebody will ask you something and he has no idea about the answer, he will say that. And he will say, I have no idea what you are talking with me. But, excuse me, I will let you know because I learn about, and then you will have my answer. Hmm. That's part of the explanation of the thing. And that's the only way to understand a leader of such dimension.
I want to ask Mr. Prodi one last question for me, and that is, what is the opportunity here for President Barack Hussein Obama to change our view, maybe even the world's view of Islam? And change the whole chemistry of what's become an ugly relationship?
Well, he has already started to do it. You know, the relation that you have in the Islamic world vis-a-vis the American president have nothing to do with a few months ago. So the problem is that he has simply to go on in the direction he started. Dialogue. This my reasons. Let us, you know, he was, in my opinion, very brave vis-a-vis the American public opinion to open the dialogue, even if, only, but with Iran. Because he simply told, okay, I think that we must have a dialogue, you know. Mm. And so I think that if the dialogue goes on, the relation with the Islamic country will change completely. Certainly not with the terrorists or this area that clearly there are out of any control. For that you will need time, generations, or you know. But with the Islamic world as, let's say, a general entity, I think that he has already changed the situation because he has created expectations. Mm. And to create expectations means that you listen. You don't cry, you American president. You listen. And this is already a great change, you know. And I'm confident that some results may come. You know, I repeat, for Israel-Palestinian conflict, you need to create an atmosphere before, you know. But even for that conflict, in the end, if you create the atmosphere, you have chances to solve the problem.
The floor is open. The statesman will take any and all questions. Stump the band leader with a quick, direct, pointed question, please.
I was wondering, since Obama was just in Turkey, how either do you think that he should handle the question of the Armenian genocide?
The question of the Armenian genocide.
Oh, yeah. Well, again, I think that this is a problem that you have to talk with the truth. And about the question that there was a genocide. And then the big issue is how are you going to be able to deal this vis-a-vis the Turkish authorities, you see? And therefore, it's in how you convince them that it's in the benefit of them to help them to solve this problem that will remain forever unless you are able to give a solution. In other words, and I'm sure that this is typical from the point of view of how perceive things President Obama, to say, look, the question of genocide is not my problem, it's your problem. And I want to help you to solve the problem, which is different. Because as long as you don't recognize what happened so many years ago in 1915 in the 20th century, well, this question is going to be on the table. And therefore, I think that, again, here you have to speak with the truth, knowing that Turkey is such an important ally from the United States, you know. It's the point number one. That's the reason why he went last Sunday there. Yeah.
Professor Gleason.
Prime Minister Prodi spoke earlier about the importance of American-Russian relations. And I'm trying now to figure out why that should be at the very, very top of the list. And one thing that occurred to me was because so much of American political attitudes up until his election was rooted in the Cold War and in the American victory in the Cold War. And maybe the panel could discuss a little bit the connection between the election of President Obama, the end of the sort of Cold War generation, the trajectory of the Cold War victory, and the coming to power of new people in the American political universe.
I didn't tell that this problem is the priority, but I think that this is easier to solve, and so for this reason probably we'll have the priority, in the sense that there is a dou des, you know, there is something that can be given from both sides without losing the face. You know, Russians simply need to have, to have safe boards and to be quiet. So the Americans need to close the front. And I don't think that there is a deep interest to put besides in Europe again. This is what, honestly, I think even cannot be openly told, not to provocate tension or fears, you know. And so I think that there is a rationale for having an agreement in this direction, you know. Both the sides will be better off, because the Americans, I think they need to have Russia not hostile for Afghanistan problems, and also for Iran. And so Russia-American, understanding will help a lot on clarifying other political problems. You know, this is what I deeply think. But I also think that it's possible, you know, because there are things that you think would be useful, but they are impossible to get. In this case, I think that also because of the economic crisis, you know, the Russians are less, let's say, hostile to, less scared to have agreements. So this is a moment in which you easily, I think, in this direction, if there is a goodwill, you can have an agreement, you know. And this will be absolutely important for the United States and absolutely important for us. Also, look, there is also another problem that, you know, I think the United States needs not to increase the military expenditure for many reasons, you know. It's it's not said, it's not, you know, this is not a debate that is heavy, deeply debated now, but it's clear that under the surface, it's clear that it's common interest to put down the cost of the military defense, you know. And so you put together this situation, and I think that it's common sense to have that you can reach these results.
Is there a last question from the young man in the back?
When, if ever, do you think we might see an African descended president of your country? And what obstacles might exist?
Sorry.
When would you expect to see a son or daughter of Africa as the president of Italy or Chile?
Oh.
And then we will declare victory and go home.
Okay.
Thank you.
This is a fantastic question, you know. Well, my answer is certainly Europe is not prepared for that. Certainly not. Maybe in the future will happen, but now they say the mixing up is much more difficult. The stratification of society is much stronger in Europe than in the United States, you know. So I think that there will be a lot of time before we have an Obama in some European country. This is what I think.
Well, I don't know. I think that there are different kind of Obamas. I think that you have more democracy and not less in Brazil when you elected a leader like Lula that was a trade union leader with a very unusual case. I think that there was more democracy and not less when you elect somebody like Evo Morales that the ethnic roots that he has was a tremendous change in that country. Or let me go to commercial now, and I would say that probably the fact that in Chile we elect a woman president was to some extent rather unusual for a very machista country, you know. And probably then a woman was some sort of Obama in that connection. what I'm trying to say is this. That if you have a country with equal opportunities at the very end, that may be possible. And let me tell you, I mentioned the other day, I was in this country for the first time when I came to study at North Carolina at Duke University. And the first thing that I saw in the Raleigh Durham airport was why men colored men? Why woman colored woman? And next day I took a bus and they told me that we white should be in the first 10 seats in the front of the bus and not in the back seat. And later I learned when in the restaurant say the owner reserved the right to admission to this restaurant, I knew that in that you couldn't do it. A Negro couldn't go there. And in 40 years, there has been a tremendous change. And this is simply because democracy at the end allow you to have these kind of changes.
Yeah,
I think that this goes beyond the way that we can believe those things can happen.
Needless to say, at that time at the university where I went, Duke University, no Negroes were accepted. And it was in my time that I saw arrive a Negro to the Faculty of Law. You see? So if this happened here because you had democracy, I think that whenever you have a democratic system, you may have a new Obamas.
Do you want to reconsider for Italy?
No, well...
I mean, we'll give you 40 years.
The answer is correct, but he thought 40 years, you know. I don't even consider 40 years horizon, you know, simply well, like that.
The question would be, how long will it take in Europe to elect somebody that is immigrant? And let me tell you, I was in Rotterdam last year, and they had elected some Muslim as mayor in Rotterdam. Well, my goodness, huh? How about that?
So we're going to regather this meeting in 40 years and count the changes.
Yeah. Thank you very much,
President Lagos and Prime Minister Prodi. Paul McCarthy edited this conversation with production help from Hannah Olson and Philip Gara at Brown University. A lot of the questions here, you'll notice, are wide open. The Obama effect, the length, depth, and meaning of the crisis, the end of the Cold War attitude in the world. So pitch your own answers to these and more at our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for joining us.